Thank you so much, Michelle, for that lovely introduction. Good evening, everyone. How's everyone doing? Well, I'm nervous, I can tell you that much. I don't know why. I mean, I do give a lot. I mean, I've been a lecturer for 11 years at Ryerson, so I should be used to giving lectures. You know, I just have a feeling you'll actually be listening to me, unlike many of my students. And I also have a few thanks I'd like to give before I start with my talk. I'm truly honored to have been chosen to deliver this year's Milton K. Wong Multiculturalism Lecture. I am grateful to Gillian Sterk for bringing my work to the attention of Robert Dom, who extended an invitation to me, and I immediately accepted. What an honor. I'm grateful to the Laurier Institution, SFU Public Square, and SFU Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, especially Janet Lynn Weber and Katie Wong, who worked really hard to make my visit possible. I also want to thank the Wong family. I just met Faye and Elizabeth this evening, and I appreciate your generosity, and not just towards me, but to keep the conversation going with this lecture. President Petter, thank you so much for making me feel so welcome. And thanks, Ian, who's been miking me up, you know, about three or four times already today. and Elder Squaglin, thank you so much for that wonderful, wonderful initiation into today's event. I'm a dedicated CBC Globe and Mail kind of guy, you know, bourgeois. I was actually a theater critic at the Globe and Mail for many years, so it's kind of funny for me to actually be on stage instead of, for 10 years, I was in the audience just taking notes in the dark. So I'm glad to have some light, and I'm going to, I've run out of excuses to get over my nervousness, so I'm just going to start. Just give me one second. All right. And you will cut all that stuff out of the broadcast, I hope. All right. Okay. Okay. Here we go. As many as 2,500 children, some as young as 3 months old, separated from their parents, possibly forever, at the Mexico-US border and housed in cages and camps. A young student who spent hours, days perhaps, reading websites and posts by far-right nationalist leaders, storms into a mosque in Quebec City and fires indiscriminately, killing 6 men and injuring many others. In Hungary, Parliament passed a law that criminalizes not just migrant and asylum seekers, but any individual or organization that tries to help them. In Italy, Matteo Salvini, deputy prime minister in the current coalition government, promised a mass cleansing street by street. His main target is the Roma people, but illegal immigrants, many of whom hail from North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, are firmly in his gaze. And in both the United States and the United Kingdom, some political leaders and high-profile communists talk of infestation, cockroaches, animals, or similar language to dehumanize immigrants and asylum seekers. These people, immigrants and asylum seekers, are no longer seen as deserving of compassion or help, but creatures that can be exterminated, allowed to drown, just like you would do with animals and cockroaches. And just yesterday, as many of you already know very well, the Supreme Court in the US upheld Donald Trump's travel ban, which restricts travel to the US from 6 mostly Muslim countries. A decade ago, like literally, if we were having this conversation in 2018, 2008. Any one of these conversations would have stood out so much. There would have been a moral panic. Any one of these examples that I just mentioned to you. The media would have a feeding frenzy on any of this story. I know, I'm a journalist. I know we would have just spent weeks and weeks just looking, for example, at what's going on in Hungary. But in this, the glorious decade of 2010s that we're living in now, there are merely dots on a world map that, when connected with numerous other examples, I could go on, but just when you connect the ones I mentioned with probably the ones you have in mind, they will reveal a much larger narrative about how we're living race today. These stories also tell us that what's happening now is not new, and in fact, played out before. The players and context may be different, but the political opportunism, the persecution on grounds of race, religion, or skin color has only shifted laterally to encompass different races, different religions, different skin colors. Any cursory reading of current news alongside history book, if you're just the kind of person who's got your history books on the shelf, but you're also on your phone scrolling through Twitter, as I always do, and if, particularly if your history books, if you have a good collection of 1930s Europe or the US in the 1940s, thinking particularly of the Japanese internment, will show debates, measures, political action whose echoes can be heard today. While racism as an issue has never disappeared from our world, it has returned with a vengeance in the last few years. So the question is, how did we get here? 73 years after the end of the Second World War, the establishment of a post-war world order in the West that saw liberal democracies thrive politically and economically. What has changed and changed so rapidly? In a word, brown. I'd like to elaborate on an argument that I first explored in my book, Brown, What Being Brown in the World Today Means to Everyone. In order to understand some or all of the recent development, I think we really need to explore that ambivalent, unique, familiar but strange, light but still dark, or not light enough, world of brown skin, the meaning of brownness as a racial experience, and the effect it's having not just on our conversations on race or multiculturalism, but politics, economy, governance, mental health, because trust me, racism is exhausting and mentally exhausting. And maybe, the future direction of the Western world. We have different frames of reference for other racial encounters. We understand the indigenous experience in terms of conquest and usurping land. We understand the black experience in terms of slavery and being dragged out of a community or a group of people being dragged out of their home continent and brought to North America, the Caribbean, and South America to work the fields for free. We have an understanding for these experiences. I'm not saying that we understand them fully, but we at least have a frame of reference. But what is our frame of reference for brownness? And what does it matter? First, I would like to define the term brown in some historical terms, but also in the way I've chosen to write and talk about it. I was actually going to, my plan was to just kind of briefly mention how I defined it in the book, and I was just like typing up and I was saying, okay, I'm going to paraphrase this, like, what the hell, I'm just going to read from the book, I'm just going to read a couple of small pages, because, you know, I'm like, why reinvent the wheel? I worked 4 years on this book, so So I'm just going to read the section where I define brownness so that when, as I talk for the rest of the lecture, if you're wondering, so what do you, Kamal, what do you mean by brownness? That we have a sense, we have a common sense in the room. I propose that we think of Brown as a continuum, a grouping, a metaphor even, for the millions of darker-skinned people who, in broader historical terms, have missed out on the economic and political gains of the post-industrial world, are now clamoring for their fair share of social mobility, equality, and freedom. Brown is the color of the 5 million Muslims in France, many of whom come from former North African French colonies. Brown is the color of the Pakistani and Indian immigrants to the United Kingdom, who arrived as the Raj gave way to post-partition chaos and violence. Brown is the color of the uprisings that have taken over the Arab world in the first half of this decade. It's the color of thousands of Egyptians, young and old, illiterate and digitally savvy, saying enough to a life of poverty and political oppression. Brown is yet another Mediterranean ghost ship carrying hundreds of Syrian or North African asylum seekers who were faced with the choice between staying put or possibly perishing en route, and still chose the latter. It's the wave of refugees knocking at Europe's door in the summer of 2015. The thwarted revolutions in Syria and Libya, as well as the ongoing instability in Iraq, have led to the displacement of about 17 million people, according to figures, the book is 2 years old, so according to figures from 2014. A population half the size of Canada is scattered across refugee camps, shelters, no man's lands. Brown represents hundreds of Nepalese, Indian, and Bangladeshi construction workers dying daily, literally an average of one a day, to build arenas and infrastructure for Qatar's 2022 World Cup. Brown is the thousands of Latin children smuggled by their own parents or traveling alone across the US-Mexico border in hope of finding a life away from drug wars, marauding militias, and extreme poverty. Some are killed when they're deported back to Central America. Of course, I wrote this before what has unfolded this the last few weeks. We're not a distinct ethnic group, but a collection with more in common than we have acknowledged before. Eugenicists have been kept all night worrying about our birth rates and concocting ways to sterilize our fecund kind before we contaminate the purity and beauty of white people. For much of our history, we've been defined by others as the brown race, the weaker tribe, as the civilization-ready subjects of empire. But the time has come for us to self-identify as we wish. There's strength in number and comfort in knowing that one's experience is not isolated or an aberration. Whenever I get pulled aside when crossing the US border, I find it reassuring that I'm not the only brown face. I see the Iraqi or Pakistani business traveler, the Colombian student, the Sri Lankan chef, or the Indian family, 3, 4, 5, 6 children. And I know that while our stories are different, we found ourselves singled out because of our brown skins and histories. We don't talk to each other, but we do exchange knowing glances. It's our lot as brown people to be treated with suspicion when we cross borders. So historically speaking, the use of color to divide people into racial groups first gained currency in the 18th century. In the scheme of humanity, that's just like fairly recently. And the 18th century is not a sort of an arbitrary point in history, but it coincided pretty much with European colonial powers carving up the world. I talk a lot in my book about German anthropologist Johann Blumenbach, who first introduced the category brown in a revised edition of one of his signature books, the called On the Natural Variety of Mankind. Up until then, the people who worked on this field, what we call racialist science, had only four groups around the world. And they were Caucasian, which corresponded to white, Ethiopian, black, Mongolian, Asian, and Mongolian, Asian, or yellow, and Native American, red. But what he did is actually added this fifth and significant new grouping of people that he called Browns, or the Malay race. It covered a large swath of what we now would call South Asia, East Asia, and the Pacific, from Thailand to Malaysia and the Pacific Islands particularly. And even at that time, he included Australia's Aboriginals. For the record, who is brown, who's white, who's yellow, who's red, was always a revolving door, and always in the eyes of the white beholder. Even now, technically speaking, if you go to the U.S., people from the Middle East in the U.S. Census Bureau are allowed to tick the white box. They can identify themselves as white, and the U.S. Census Bureau actually identifies them as white. But you'd be hard-pressed to convince anyone, particularly in the Trump administration, that a dark-skinned Egyptian Muslim man of a certain age would be considered white in any social or political sense. So who's white and who's not, who's brown, is always fluid, is always subject to political interpretations. Although that science was basically has been proven to be hokum, it actually continued well into the 20th century. But within that thinking, the white Caucasian race represented not just physical beauty, but strength, moral character, good temperament. Every time you have a hierarchy, you have people at the top and you have people at the bottom. And in this hierarchy, the bottom was occupied by the black race, black people. Brown, in particular, formed a buffer space, a middle ground, on the cusp of whiteness and on the edge of blackness. As you can see from the section that I read, I'm not using brown and brownness in those terms, and by no means am I suggesting that racialist science is to be taken seriously. But what is probably quite startling is that how many of those ideas have survived well into the second half of the 20th century. In fact, a contemporary of Lubin Bach was Christoph Mainers, his fortunes were revived in the 1920s and 30s by the Nazis, because he obviously talked about the beauty and the purity of the Aryan race. But that so-called racialist science set the blueprint for how brownness came to be understood, or more accurately, misunderstood around the world. How its middle space, that buffer zone, has worked to facilitate the exploitation of both black and brown population, and the competition for resources between two non-white groups in different historical settings. The one I spend a lot of time talking about in my book is actually concerns importing brown indentured labor to parts of the Caribbean, particularly Trinidad and Guyana, to make up for and destabilize the political powers of the newly freed slaves of African origin. The indentured labor. I see brown as both real and metaphorical. While my starting point is really looking at it in very basic term, what is your skin color? What is your skin tone? And are you black or white? And if you're not, what sort of that middle ground? What are you? But I also want to focus on a few things here. The key element, or my key argument in the book, is that brown has become the source of cheap labor. The second one is the colorization of Islam as a brown menace in the post 9/11 world. There are more than a billion followers of Islam, for example, and whenever people think of Muslims, they think of this swarthy, bearded man who comes from the Middle East, or a woman wearing the niqab, and even though you can only see your eyes, you kind of guess that she might be brown. So these are the kind of two of my main arguments in the book, that brown has become the color of cheap labor, and explore that in more depth in the talk, and the colorization of Islam as a brown menace. And in very broad strokes, an anxiety about immigration from specific geographic locations that just happened to correspond neatly to a brown classification. I'm thinking of the Middle East, North Africa, South and South Asia, Southeast Asia, Mexico, and parts of Central and South America, the brown world. You'll hear me mention the word anxiety a few times, and I think it's really what's going on now is an anxiety that is bordering on a moral panic. This anxiety can be economic, cultural, or even about larger demographic trends, as I'll show in the course of this talk. That said, it's really hard for me to separate all these issues, and I think, as you'll see, they're pretty much connected. But what I can do is offer some specific examples, some contemporary, some historical, to make my points. Let me start by saying, how many of you remember a summer day, early morning, June 2015, when Donald Trump announced his presidential bid, a year before he actually won the Republican Party nomination? How many remember that? And what do you remember about that particular day? Is anyone? Yeah, go. He came down the escalator, okay, all right. In terms of what he said? Okay, all right. The Mexican, yes, okay. That was like his opening salvo into the presidential bid. He immediately, deliberately went after two groups. The first one was actually, before he even elaborated on the Mexican, I don't know the sequence, to be perfectly honest, but that was when he started talking about, you know, we have to stop Muslims from coming in until we know what the hell is going on. And then he actually went on a tirade against illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants, particularly from Mexico, who he claimed they bring drugs, they bring crime, and commit rape. The choice of particularly Mexican undocumented migrants as a group to target and to rally his future base was, in pure political terms, a masterstroke. Morally, of course, is abhorrent. I know that, you know that. But if you are one of those politician or strategist, then you know, when you studied that, you know that was genius. Here's a word, here's something you don't think of, a phrase you don't think of every day, Donald Trump and genius. But it set the tone for the rest of his campaign and much of his presidency to date. By designated undocumented migrants, Trump knew he could tap into certain fears, and one of them is the brown migrant as potentially more criminal than American-born citizens. That's what he and his base believe, and that's what they want us to believe. But what do the facts say? What do studies reveal? As long as I'm drawing breath, facts still matter. As long as I can speak, and as a journalist, I still believe that you should try to get the facts and get to the truth of the matter, and also as an academic. A recent study in a peer-reviewed journal called Criminology found that there is absolutely no evidence that there's a sharp increase in illegal immigration, and what the people who did the study referred to as a jump in violent crime. The study covered almost 28 years of data. So the White House claim that there is undocumented migrants bring violence, and that the communities where they live is clearly false. In a separate study, the same researchers looked at nonviolent crime and found the results to be comparable. A third study by a think tank found that native-born Americans actually had a higher conviction and arrest rates than illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants. There is an interview with the police chief in Texas that aired on NPR earlier this year, And there was the quote from the chief of police is so striking that I'd like to read it in its entirety. "There is no wave of crime being committed by the immigrant community. As a matter of fact, a lot of the violent crimes we're dealing with is being committed by people that are born and raised right here in the United States." Unquote. Border cities are often portrayed as dangerous, violent, drug-addled spaces, but again, reports and crime rates suggest otherwise. So with the safety fear comes some specific economic anxieties, in particular with white voters with no college education, what, you know, in a previous generation would have been called the working class. This fear builds on another claim that migrants depress wages. There's an argument that it's harder to quantify as and is part of a larger conversation about labor and immigration. But what's missing from this claim are some very crucial facts. One, automation, which has and will continue to render many industrial jobs obsolete. At the rate things are going, they will render some teaching jobs obsolete because everyone is doing what's called MOOCs, I guess, the digital sort of models. There's also outsourcing, whether to Mexico or China or India, which corporate America has embraced for the last 30 years. There's also the continuous devaluing of unions and collective bargaining. So do some immigrants put pressure on wages? Perhaps. Are they the only reason wages are lower and jobs disappearing? Hardly. To put it simply, if these undocumented brown workers, particularly I'm thinking of the Mexicans in the US, manage to cross the border illegally, how come many of them stay, have children, and in many cases thrive for decades? The simple answer is that for the two decades prior to the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the American economy depended on the cheap labor it can extract or exploit out of brown immigrants, particularly in jobs that the vast majority of American-born workers would not accept. By that I mean very labor-intensive, poorly paid work in the food and agriculture sectors, in some industrial settings, in the catering and restaurant industry. If you've been to a kitchen in any North American large city in the last decade, you'll be hard-pressed to find many white workers in the kitchen. Before the recession, the border states like Arizona, Texas, and California, in those states, you couldn't get undocumented workers fast enough into the country. A booming economy needs university-educated workers, needs people who work in very creatively, the knowledge economy. But it also depends on the labors of millions of unskilled or low-skilled workers. Who will build work at the hotels, restaurants, and spas that people with disposable income frequent? Well, brown people will. People from Central America, India, Bangladesh will. As you read one story after another about Silicon Valley, for example, we all think of Silicon Valley as the mecca of American digital innovation. I want you to remember tens of thousands of South Asians who work there on a temporary work visa called H-1B. They are the brown elves of the digital workshop. They're writing code, programming, often bust in and out of workplaces, living in dormitory-style lodgings, hardly what any of them would call the American dream. To be brown has become a global symbol for cheap labor around the world. Immigrants from brown countries have become the go-to group for mass labor that pays less than what local populations would have accepted for a similar job. As I said, we're concentrated in labor-intensive jobs. If I do like a quick roll call of them, cab driving, construction, elderly and childcare, fast food, supermarket, fruit and vegetable picking, gardening, security, night shift, call centers, and the list goes on. So what does the connection between skin color and certain sectors of the economy tell us about the world we live in today? About a division of labor along racial lines, about communities that have been that have come together, not because they share values or ethnic origins, but the work they do. What exactly does it mean to outsource care for the elderly and child care to Filipino nannies and caregivers? What does that say about how we value our most vulnerable segments of the population? I mentioned earlier the indentured labor from India and South Asia in the Caribbean, and I can't help but draw similarities between that historical moment and our current addiction to imported cheap labor that sometimes get the euphemism of temporary foreign worker programs. If you allow me to move just briefly from North America to Europe, European context, if you ever wondered why there are so many North Africans in France, South Asians in the United Kingdom in particular, most people will say, you know, there are colonialism. You, as the saying goes, you know, we are here because you were there. And to that I'll also add Turkish and Germany, although that is a different, that's a guest worker system that is different. But the real reasons we have so many North Africans in France or South Asians in Britain is they were needed. They were needed to actually rebuild these countries after the Second World War. The devastation was not just in physical structures, but actually in the manpower, in the workers. There are simply not enough workers to go to mines to work in factories. That's why some of the South Asian immigration patterns in England is in the north, which was the industrial heart of England at the time. As I said, there is a saying that we are here because you were there, but that totally obscures the picture. We are here because you needed us. The you I'm talking about is a universal one. Any place in the world where there's a shortage of labor and you turn to brown people to say, come in and work. This pattern of importing labor when a country's population cannot meet demands of its economic boom accelerated globally in the 1970s. Countries as diverse as Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and places like Hong Kong, even while it was still under British control, tried to fill in labor shortages in industries as different as construction, child and elderly care, food and hospitality with workers from the Philippines, Indonesia, India, Egypt, and more recently, increasingly, actually workers from both Africa and parts of mainland China. The critical mass, however, remains brown workers. To give you just an example, to bring that to life, if you go to a country like Qatar, the native population is actually only 6%. 94% are foreign workers and expats. And I divide the terms because expat is a term that is usually kind of refers to European or white workers, whereas everyone else gets called a migrant worker. The global economy runs on the labor of brown migrants and immigrants. I make an argument that it's the hidden foundation of this century. But every time I don't know about you, but today I was watching business television. I like watching business television because I don't understand it and I can think about other things while I'm watching it. I'm always kind of fascinated by all the charts going up and down the screen and the ticker tape and they talk about hedge funds and they have experts every like 5 minutes someone come in and talk about the company's performances and the stock market, and it makes the economy look like literally you do have to have a PhD from the London School of Economics to understand business television, but I actually think that, yes, that is a complex picture that you know, sort of to study the economy and to study it or to present it to in a business channel or a business newspaper. I used to be an editor at a Report and Business magazine. You know, it requires a certain kind of expert terminology. But really, the global economy is a very simple thing. It actually depends on people whose lives are caught in it, and it follows, and their lives follow a very simple human desire to do better for themselves and their children. Everyone here in the room who has children or grandchildren can relate to that. You want them to have a better life, or at the very least, you want to pass on the life you've had to them so that they can enjoy the many privileges and nice life that you had. And trust me, no mother wants to leave her children behind to raise other people's children for career reasons. Every domestic worker I've spoken to said she's doing that so that her children doesn't have to do it. And no father is willing to risk his life working on a skyscraper in Doha, where the temperature can rise to up to 50 Celsius in the afternoon, if they had another way of making a living. As I said, I talked to many workers from Mexico, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and I'm always struck by the similarities of their stories. They're stories of resilience, pride. Sure, there's a lot of suffering, but they're doing it to give their kids, their children, and their community, actually, something different. So how come the stories that we tell about these globe-trotting, intrepid workers are ones of fear, incomprehension, invasion? And if you're following something like the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar, then you know that the same anti-brown sentiments are brewing in parts of Asia as well. 70 years after North African, South Asian, and Turkish workers relocated to Europe, the children of these migrant workers are often lumped together with refugees and asylum seekers in larger discussions about multiculturalism, national identity, and polluting the ethnic purity of Europe. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, it was easier for Muslim communities in Europe, or for communities in Europe in general, to place the blame elsewhere. It was Muslims in Muslim countries. If you look at the hijackers on 9/11, 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia alone, 15 out of 19. But things got much more complicated, particularly in the last 10 years, when the terrorists are revealed to have been brown men, and they're always men, born and raised in the UK, in France, in Belgium. The threat changes from an outside to an inside one. We enter the territory of the enemy within. I fear that your next-door neighbor, your co-workers, your classmates may be plotting a mass murder, using anything from bombs to cars as weapons. But strangely enough, this somewhat legitimate fear is not what's galvanizing leaders of far-right parties and their followers. They're not necessarily obsessed with the security element. Anti-Muslim sentiments live in a much more existential realm. They tend to focus on issues of values, ways of life, French ideals, or Britishness, for example. I remember distinctly reading something about former Prime Minister of the UK, John Major, saying that his ideal England is old ladies cycling through a church on a Sunday afternoon, cycling on their way to church on a Sunday afternoon in a country lane. And that's what England should be about. And some of these images, ideas start with pretty good, you know, with reasonably good intention. In 2004, citing the laicite principle, which is sort of separates church from state, and it's a secular model, very French model, the government of Jacques Chirac passed a law that would ban all religious symbols in schools. Despite a language that included the cultural insignia of almost all major religion, the law was understood as a last resort to stem the tide of Islamic religiosity. Its advocates believed that the law would uphold the principles of secularism and send a strong message about an intolerant version of Islam that discriminates against women. Critics pointed to the law's potential to inflame the militant tendencies of young generation of Muslims, increasing their sense of alienation, and argued to sort of modernize that law. What Chirac's law really started was a culture war that inadvertently legitimized the anti-Muslim rhetoric of the far right, the National Front of the Le Pen father and daughter. By 2017, that once fringe party came pretty close to winning the French elections. So between 2004 and 2017, we've seen such a radical shift in France. What all of that makes me sort of think of is societies that want immigrant workers, but not people. There's a very famous, I believe, Austrian playwright who I quote in the book, and I'm sorry, I forgot his name completely, who says, we wanted workers, we got people. In pretty much, you know, you want a machine to do the job, basically, not people who have views, values, families they wish to be reunited with. Whether it's the Muslim population in Europe or the Hispanic community in the US, brown presence in predominantly white societies is being politically weaponized. What worries me, in addition to the verbal and political attack, is that this weaponization is becoming more literal almost every day. As someone who lived and studied in England for 8 years, I've been watching the shift in how brown communities are discussed and talked about, from simple issues of the rights and wrongs of multiculturalism to the divisiveness of the Brexit campaign, in which one side, ultimately the winning side, fought it on an explicitly anti-immigration, anti-refugee, and anti-Muslim platform. If what's going on in Europe right now is not a war, at least it's a fight. Liberal democracies are fighting for their lives against the rise of ethnic nationalism, race-based politics, and a generous helping of the playbook and sometimes the checkbooks of fascists and dictators. Anti-brown politics, anti-brown discrimination is destabilizing entire countries, systems of governance that have been in place for decades, and replacing it with what has rightly been described as the dictatorship of the majority. If you look back at the title of my talk, there's the second part of these the title that says, "What now?" So I'm coming to the part now, which means we're getting pretty close to the end. I often read a quote on Twitter that goes along the lines of, you can judge a society by how it treats its most vulnerable or its minorities. I think it's a beautiful sentiment. I admire it a lot. But I'm not wholeheartedly sold on it, because in places like Canada and the US, brown communities are actually one of the few demographic groups showing signs of growth. In Toronto, 1 in 4 people in the GTA will be of South Asian descent in under 2 decades. Hispanics will count for 1 in 3 Americans by 2060. So very soon, it would not be about helping the vulnerable or statistically small, but about the world that we, all of us, choose to live in. If you really look at that statistic of the 2061, you can actually try to understand why white nationalism is returning to American politics, particularly to the Republican Party. It'll either be a world marked by racial strife and possibly war, or one where our better natures, our better values of equality, of fairness, will prevail. Am I optimistic about the future? And do I think we in Canada are immune from these larger global movements? The answer, I'm afraid, is no. I'm not actually optimistic at all. In fact, I'm getting more pessimistic every day. I predict that our next federal election, which is over a year from now, will be a referendum on issues like refugees and immigration policies. and that it will see its fair share of race baiting and will echo some of the current politics of the US. I say the word echo, but actually we need to take credit where credit is due, because much of the politics that we're seeing in the US actually started right here in Canada. If you look at Ford Nation in Ontario, they serve anti-intellectual, simple messages. Or if you look at a prime minister who tried to get value from his followers by demonizing a certain group, that would be Stephen Harper, in case you're not sure who I'm talking about, that actually did start here in Canada. In fact, I've sort of shifted my thinking about it, but there was a time when I thought the blueprint for Trump was actually made here in Canada. The tone would be different, perhaps less nasty, but when stripped of our sort of Canadian politeness, we will write our own chapter of the Brown Book. What will be in that chapter, I really, really hope, I really wish I could tell you. I know that empathy alone is not going to get us out of this mess. What we need is policies. What we need is an electorate that is vigilant and watching, perhaps even learning from what's going on in the US, that democracy is not something you should take for granted. What we do now, in the next year or two, what we say will affect not just the lives of brown people, but really all of our lives together, because I don't know how to sort of say it except in a cliche, we're all in this together. Thank you so much.